First, though, tea at three, and our guest today is the singer and songwriter Ralph McTell. Best known, I guess, for his haunting hit The Streets of London, Ralph has been at the very top of the acoustic scene for decades. He's often on tour, and indeed his latest one brings him to Martlets Hall in Burgess Hill tomorrow night. So we're thrilled that we can have him for tea at three today. Hello, Ralph.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Bill.
Yeah, is it a venue that you've played many times before, the Martlets?
No, I'll tell you, I know Burgess Hill because when I was very much younger, I used to hitchhike down to Brighton a lot, and I used to see that sign to Burgess Hill. I've never been there, actually, so just when you think you've been everywhere, there's Burgess Hill.
Well, will you get there in time to have a bit of a snoop around then, Jay?
Well, I think probably we normally get into the theatres about between 3 and 4 to set up and everything, so maybe I'll have a little stroll round and have a little look at the place.
Very nice. And what will the set comprise of?
Well, it's difficult these days. There's just so many songs to choose from, but inevitably I will play my hit, but I will be looking backwards and forwards. I think that's... I try to sort of pull songs from the very dim, distant past, you know, from my first album came out in 1967, 68.
Wow.
So there's an awful lot of material out there. So I'll be diving right back and coming right forward. I've actually got couple of new things to play as well, so how are we going to squeeze everything in? I don't know, but have fun trying anyway.
You call it the hit, and of course everybody knows exactly what you mean, and I couldn't resist referring to it in my introduction even.
No, that's okay.
Well, is it okay? I mean, is it a little bit of a millstone? Do you wish people would talk more about other things that you've done, other songs that you've written?
Well, of course, but you can't have a little millstone, can you? There's always a great big thing like hanging around your neck. And
is it a great big millstone?
Well, it is, but it's not an unpleasant one. I mean, the thing is, the song has substance, and it has come to mean so much, not just to the general public. And I'm not being... I don't want to be falsely modest. I mean, I'm always amazed that I had any success at all, because with anything in terms of songwriting, it's something I was never striving to make hits. I was only striving to express my feelings, and I just had this bit of luck, as you might say, because it's earned me some money, but it's also prevented a lot of other stuff coming through, because if you've only ever had one, and it's kind of got this sort of, I don't know, social... religioso, I don't know. It gets used in schools, in churches, and all sorts of places. And it's used as a guitar tutorial and everything. So it's got lots of little things going for it. And, you know, you can't help sometimes thinking, oh, I wish I could get away from it. But as soon as I start to sing it, I get into it again, and it's not like, I always tell people, you know, the number one slot that year was held by Mudd with a song called Are You Lonesome This Christmas. Now, if I'd had to sing that every night since 1974,
yes.
I might feel differently about it, but I certainly don't about Streets. No, I don't feel bad about it at all.
When you were writing it, presumably it just felt like writing one of the many songs that you were writing at the time, didn't
Absolutely.
It
was just, this is a good topic to have a go at. Let's see where this goes. And exactly. And then for years it was three verses. It finished with the old man in the all night cafe. And then I thought it's sort of left hanging there. So the next verse got written, I mean, probably a year later. And that's how most people know the song, with four verses and four choruses. Yeah.
And do we have any idea how many covers there have been of it?
Well, the documented covers, those are from people that have been polite enough to write to the publishers and say, is it all right if we record this? There are about 212 or 13 acknowledged covers, but of course there's a lot more than that.
Any you particularly like, or any that you cannot bear?
There's quite a few. I'm not going to name anyone. But there's some very fine ones. Glenn Campbell did a particularly fine one. Harry Belafonte did a beautiful version. Cleo Lane. There's a lot of really, really nice ones, you know.
Hear people like that doing your songs, I was reading through the biog, and the name of another fine composer of a rather different style leapt out at me, Ralph Vaughan Williams.
Yes.
What was the connection there?
Well, my dad was... he's a bit of a shadowy figure, my dad. I didn't know him at all. He left our family home quite early and moved down to a place near Lawton in Sussex, near Brighton somewhere, where he unfortunately was killed in an accident. That's how we got to hear where he was.
Gosh.
But apparently, he was born in a place called Addington in Surrey, and his father worked for, I think, the Archbishop of Canterbury's estates there, and also worked as a gardener for Ray Vaughan Williams. And my father apparently told my mother that he liked that music, and and they thought Rafe was rather a good name, a bit posh for us working class people, but so he changed it to Ralph, and I've always been called Ralph, and apparently that is my connection with Rafe.
So you are named after Mr. Vaughan Williams. Quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
You've been quoted in the past as saying that your father's desertion shaped you totally. Do you still stand by that, and what exactly do you mean by it?
Well, absolutely. I think I was probably a sensitive little boy anyway, and I was very well aware of the impact that it had on our family from the moment he went and the door slammed. And you know, that colours the way you view what your mum does. And you know, in those days there wasn't the kind of help available to people, and mum went out and worked, scrubbed doorsteps even. She did everything to keep this, our little family together.
Which was you and your brother.
My brother and myself,
yeah.
And her, yeah. And of course we went without, although we didn't feel that we went without, because we were together, and we roughed it together, and it was extremely tough. And when people say it was tough for everybody, it might well have been after the war, but it was tougher for us because there was no money, and mum kind of kept everything together. So that sensitivity to that situation, music and words and poems and stories were incredibly important to me. They gave me a great deal of comfort, and eventually led me into music, which has been my life. So I have to say that it shaped me totally.
Now, again, reading in the notes, I was interested to see a section on your discovering of black music, because if there's one kind of music that one perhaps doesn't think of in connection with you, it would probably be that, wouldn't it?
Well, it's absolutely. I mean, it's a strange phenomenon that English working class lads took American black music back to America and made it popular, and lots of them, like B.B. King was on TV recently, the great blues guitar player, and saying thank you very much for doing that, because it raised the profile of black music, especially blues, and for me especially the guitar, because these men often, you know, surmounted dreadful disabilities and blindness and all sorts of ailments and, you know, disablements to produce the most incredible, beautiful, original American art form, which is blues and jazz. And we picked up on the message. Post-war kids seemed to pick up on the message of the songs, and of course I wanted to play guitar like that, and I have my collection comprises a huge amount of black acoustic blues music, and I still listen and am amazed and full of wonder at what they managed to achieve, and I'm still learning from them. I'm still trying to play like them, and of course I don't play blues exactly, but the techniques that I have, well, I do play blues actually, but the techniques I have learned from fingerstyle playing have guided my accompaniments and compositions to my own songs.
The other thing that surprised me, because you don't associate it with a tortured artistic guitar balladeer, was army life, but you even tried that out for a short while.
Well, that's the typical refuge for the wayward boy, isn't it? I mean, as an amateur kind of sociologist, if you like, at 15 when I joined up, because you could, and I think you still can, join up at 15, I discovered to my utter amazement that there was only one boy in our recruit intake that had both parents at home.
Mm.
We were all from broken homes, every man jack of us, and the army's always known that. It used to recruit out of orphanages and Barnardos and so on, and boys from broken homes or single-parent families are somehow drawn to the kind of family that the army suggests it might be. So you have the security of belonging to something, and yet you have the adventure and the channel for your bravado and so on. You find out immediately on arrival it's not all skiing and
and one big loving kind family necessarily
exactly,
either.
Mundo, but at the time it seemed a way of getting out from under and exploring something different and having a little dignity, and possibly, although I wouldn't be aware of that word, but getting out of the responsibility of coming up to the standard that my dear old mum's sacrifices deserved, you know.
How did your dear old mum felt having sacrificed when you then became a busker?
I think she wouldn't have known about half the things I did.
Ah.
And I've kept it that way, although I've written it down in a book, and she tells me she's read it. I know the bookmark was stuck in the same place in the book for quite a while where it deals with my dad leaving, but apparently she has read it now.
But she hasn't commented, though.
She hasn't commented,
no. No. And what was busking like? You travelled fairly extensively, didn't you?
Well, I have to say that The whole road and music dream were wrapped up as one, and that the guitar gave me the artistic sort of impetus, and the road presented the never-ending dream. As a matter of fact, I still feel largely that way, even though the road goes on forever. They were coupled together somehow, and then because I could play a little bit and I was hungry, there was some sort of, I don't know, they harmonized together, and I played on the street, and I traveled through Europe playing the guitar in street corners, and sometimes with a pal, sometimes on my own, and it was a wonderful adventure, and I learned a lot. I confirmed a lot of doubts and suspicions that I had anyway, and I felt that I was earning my dues. I was learning my trade. I mean, I don't play the way that I played on the street anymore, because, you know, I play fingerstyle and you wouldn't be able to hear that, but I learned a lot. I traveled a lot. I was lonely a lot. I had to think a lot, and I've actually just written a song about it, actually, because I felt it sort of coming round a full circle. I still got a lot to do, but I've actually identified that mixture of mystery and mystique and the spirituality of what was going on, along with the music and the journey. So
interesting. And who knows whether you'd ever have written The Streets of London without experiencing surviving in a grotty room in Paris and freezing to death in the winter there.
I think that's probably true as well. I think that observing people like in France, a lot of the old guys sleep over the hot air gratings from the metro because it's a little bit of warmth, but they still take their boots off, or they did in those days, and put them under their heads because somebody's likely to come along and steal their boots. I mean, it's that tough, and Paris is cold in the winter. It really is cold, and it comes home to you what it must be like to have no shelter at all.
So what was the big break, Ralph?
Well, the big confusion was the song. The big break, I don't know. I've just been lucky enough to, right from the very earliest attempts at playing guitar, I've been able to communicate with the ideas. And although I would like to have aspired to a higher art, and I was going to be Bob Dylan, actually, but he did it first. So, I mean, I think sometimes I would have loved that influence. And now when I look back, I think, no, that's a very lonely road to hoe. And who would I be looking towards? Who would I be looking at? And who would I be listening to and pondering his particular journey? So my break has just been that through the guitar and through the songs that I've written, I've managed to
I thought you
keep
might
working.
Say getting recording deals like the Transatlantic deal.
They're two-edged swords, you know, to be honest with you. People say to me, young writers come up, young players say, how do we get a recording? I say, I don't know. Why do you want one? What do you want one for? It used to be awarded as a kind of measure of somebody. What it actually means is that somebody thinks they can make money out of you. That's what it actually means. And
doesn't it mean a lot more people hear your music?
It can do, but I'm not aware of anyone playing mine.
No, but listen, you know, you can go into a shop and buy a Ralph McTell CD
or
old-fashioned record, and if you hadn't got a recording deal, I wouldn't be able to do that, would I?
Well, that's true too, but you see, about 80% of the people that I know that work on the acoustic scene make their own records, and you can record at home if you want to hear how you sound.
It's all going that way, of course, isn't it?
Yes, it is, really, and, you know,
Democratisation, you might call it.
It is, really, and downloading music off the internet and so on. I really don't know what to say, I just say music is the thing that drives me, and occasionally, you know, we get a bunch of songs, we put them down and people can take them home. But I think still they prefer to come and see the shows live. But it does give you a chance to let the perhaps slightly more complex songs soak in a little bit more if you get them on record. But I'd be very dubious about accepting a recording deal these days. Really what you want is the guarantee that you're going to get heard, not that you're going to build up a huge debt of studio time and so on.
Very
so
interesting.
It's a tricky old decision to make.
Billy Connolly, we know, rates you. He's described you as a national treasure. Not bad for a Scot saying that to an Englishman, I have to say. And, of course, we've heard some of your music via him on the telly just recently, haven't we?
Well, yes. Billy and I were on the same label, and I'm sure he would have felt exactly the same as me when, you know, to be awarded the chance to make a record, although he was a serious musician in that, and he still is, actually. He's a very, very fine musician, and especially on the banjo, and he has a deep affection for early American music and English and Scots traditional music as well. So we were bonded right from the start, and of course his humour took over, and we all know what happened to Billy. Became a huge star, but we were on the same label together in those early days at Transatlantic, and we've remained friends ever since. And he does seem to be a little at ease with me when we're in the studio together. We have fun playing. He's kind of a nervous performer, so
that's
I've
interesting to hear, I must say. You tend to think about your bravado, you know, and gagging around and so forth.
Well, I think he could do that. It's when he's put under the microscope and you actually only end up performing to the studio engineer and your producer, and you can only do it a couple of times, and it goes off. So with Billy and I, we try and know what we're going to do a little bit before we go in, and if we don't get it down in two takes, it ain't going to happen, and that's it. So Bill's come to me a couple of times and said, let's do some stuff, or can you help me out with this, and it's been an absolute privilege and an honour, and I love doing it.
We'll hear the music in question in just a moment and give details of the CD from which it comes. First of all, though, we must mention that you'll be at the Martlets Hall in Burgess Hill tomorrow night, 8 o'clock start. Tickets are a trifling £15 on 01444 242 888. 01444 242 888. It's been an absolute pleasure, Ralph. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bill.
We must do part two of the story in the day. The other day, we only got to the early 70s, didn't we?
Yeah, that's right.
We shall reconvene another time. Thank you for being at E3.
A pleasure.
Sands of smoke on desert wind, beneath the Southern Cross. Far beyond where time begins, generations lost. I could not be further from you now, with both feet on the ground, but in the dream time. Souls take flight, and I am closer to you now. If I should lay me down to sleep by forest green or shining lake, I could arise to find it gone, to take for granted my mistake. Yet I could not be further from you now, with both feet on the ground, but in the dreamtime. Souls take flight, and I am closer to you now. Mountains crumble, forests vanish, seeds awaken by the fire. Water, air, and earth have borne them, and I can feel my own ones near. Yet I could not be further from you now, with both feet on the ground, but in the dreamtime. Souls take flight, and I am closer to you now. Flowers flames are dancing in the fire. Timeless songs are on the air. In the wilderness they're crying, but there is laughter everywhere. And I cannot be further from you now, with both feet on the ground. But in the dreams, souls take flight, I am closer to you now. I am closer to you.
Nice, wasn't it?
Very nice.
That was nice.
And what a lovely man as well. He really is. God bless him. Ralph McTell. Red Sky, the name of the CD from which that track came, which was called In the Dreamtime.